From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's no secret that members of the Bush administration value secrecy, but perhaps none more than David Addington, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff and his longtime legal advisor. He doesn't speak with the press or allow photos of himself to be taken for news stories, even keeps the door to his office locked at all times. But under the radar, Mr. Addington has crafted a legal foundation for some of the most controversial items on the Bush agenda. He was the subject of a July 3rd article in The New Yorker called The Hidden Power, The Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror. And I'm joined now by the author of that article, Jane Mayer. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Now, Jane, after the article appeared, a case was decided by the Supreme Court that directly related to it.
The Hamdan case, yes, which threw out the Bush administration's idea of what military tribunals could be. The tribunals were so much designed by this man, David Addington, that in many ways it was a direct rebuke to much of his worldview.
Although he hasn't been fired as a result.
Oh, not at all. In fact, I'd say it's an open question about whether or not the Bush administration will change very much now. In fact, what they're trying to do rather than change is to get the laws to change to accommodate them. They're trying to get Congress to rewrite the laws so that their kind of tribunals can continue.
How much of the administration's legal policy is David Addington responsible for?
Well, I mean, I have to say, you know, when you cover the Bush administration, you always speak with a certain amount of doubt because it's very hard to get inside enough to know everything. But the people that I interviewed, and I must have interviewed maybe 60 people for this story, many of whom were lawyers top places in the administration, say that David Addington, though nobody's heard of him almost outside of Washington, is just the key player. He's described by people as the force inside the room. He's the lawyer that drives everything. I mean, one top lawyer said to me, "It's Addington. Everything is Addington."
Well, why is such an influential figure working for the vice president and not directly for the president? Does he have more clout than Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez?
Isn't that interesting? I mean, the same question I had as a reporter was, who is this guy and why does he seem to be calling all the shots? Yes, people tell me he has quite a bit more legal clout than our Attorney General Gonzalez. And the reason is that David Addington, unlike Gonzalez, is an expert in the area of national security law, and he came into this job with decades of wisdom about the subject and very, very strong and very extreme views on it. And he's kind of an arrogant guy in the way that people describe him. He doesn't suffer fools gladly, and he tells other people when they don't know what they're talking about. And by contrast, Gonzalez is quite an affable guy and somewhat meek. So Addington just basically called the shots and ruled the day inside of the inner councils of the Bush administration right after September 11th.
So let's go back to that time, November 2001, when President Bush signed an executive order that established military commissions to try foreign terror suspects. Addington played a major role in formulating that order?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a small handful of lawyers who really designed the policy, so the administration's legal approach to the war on terror. One was a young lawyer in the Justice Department named John Yoo, who was in a fairly lowly position at the Office of Legal Counsel, but he also is a very creative and powerful sort of mind. He had very intriguing and extreme theories, and they were theories that matched Addington's theories. And so John Yoo, David Addington, to some extent Gonzalez, who at that time was the White House counsel, and a handful of other young lawyers really pretty much figured out what how we would fight back against terrorism.
Is it true that the drafts weren't shown to Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice?
Oh, yeah. They were very bold.
They were out of the loop?
They cut out many of the top people in the administration, including what's interesting to me is that while they were crafting what was in essence the legal rules for how the military would act, they cut most of the military's experts out, people who were experts in the laws on war, people who understood how the Geneva Conventions work and why the Geneva Conventions work. And they went into a sort of a small little cell group and designed the rules on their own for the tribunals, and then basically told the Secretary of State, the CIA, and the Pentagon what those rules would be at the end of the day.
Any idea of how they responded?
Some of them were apoplectic. In particular, the CIA was very upset that they hadn't been brought into the process, and Secretary Powell's people tried to fight back. They basically said, you know, these rules will not work. We can't live with this. This is going to create an international problem. If you create Guantanamo and if you throw out the Geneva Conventions and treat detainees as if they have no rights, we're going to have problems with our allies. They're not going to want to work with us.
And they had problems with the Supreme Court as well, a conservative Supreme Court.
Well, and there were lawyers who told them that they might have problems with the Supreme Court. I think they felt, I mean, you have to understand, there is a central thesis that is underlying David Addington's worldview in all of this. And it's also Dick Cheney's thesis. The notion is that in a war, at times of war, like the war on terrorism, the country will be stronger if the chief executive, the president, pretty much can do whatever he wants to do outside, whether or not it conflicts with smaller laws. If it's in the name of national security, they feel they can set aside things like the Geneva Conventions. They can set aside things like the laws that say that torture is illegal when you're interrogating people, and other laws such as the laws that circumscribe spying on people with the NSA. So their argument was that if it's in the name of making the country safer, it's necessary and we can do it. And that's what the Supreme Court, in the end of the day, has so far bridled at.
Also goes against conservative theology, doesn't it? Smaller
some,
government.
Some conservative theology. It's interesting. The worldview of Dick Cheney and David Addington has split conservatives. And you'll see in the story, there are a number of conservative lawyers who are, I would say, as upset, maybe more upset than the liberals are about this. That's what's so interesting about this administration. Really, the criticism is not necessarily where you would think it was coming from, where you think it would come from. It comes from conservative lawyers who see this as Big Brother, who's, you know, tyrannical. And it also comes from the military, which very loudly and clearly feels that if there are no rules governing how we interrogate our prisoners, that our soldiers will be subjected to the same terrible treatment if they're taken prisoner. And they don't want that to happen.
My guest is Jane Mayer of The New Yorker. She wrote an article for the July 3rd issue called The Hidden Power, The Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror. And you also write that the famous 2002 memo, January 2002, signed by Alberto Gonzalez, that dismissed the Geneva Conventions as obsolete and quaint, may very well have had the influence of David Addington on them.
Oh, I think it quite definitely had his influence. The question is whether or not he actually wrote those words, the famous words that described the Geneva Conventions as quaint and obsolete. He really is a sort of a takeover artist in the area of the law inside the White House, and he certainly had his imprint and fingerprints on all of these memos, the ones that have become so controversial belatedly.
So does he? What happens when you talk about torture as something that some people consider to be unacceptable? Does he just not even concern himself with torture? Is this really all about expanding presidential power, as you say?
It is to him. I mean, one of the lawyers that works with him said to me, you know, it's not that he is so in favor of torture. It's just he feels that if the president wants torture, the president should get torture. It's an issue of executive power for him. I mean, there's a story in this story about a number of people on the National Security Council who went to him after Guantanamo was set up. And they were very concerned because a CIA officer had gone down to Guantanamo and interviewed a number of the detainees, and he came back with bad news. What he told them was, uh-oh, we've got a lot of people down there for whom there are no charges. We can't, you know, they may be innocent. We better check out a little more closely who we've got. And David Addington's point of view was, if they're down there, they're guilty. And so, you know, he's not somebody who's been concerned with human rights. I think you could say that pretty completely. He's somebody who's completely obsessed with what he sees as making the country stronger. And, you know, he has defenders who will say that, you know, he's driven to protect all of us. And I think what's interesting to me is that there are a number of people who would argue that the extreme measures that he's supported have made the country so unpopular that maybe they've had a, you know, they've undercut our security rather than enhancing it.
Where does he come from?
His father was a general in the army, and he grew up all around the world, but mostly in the Southwest. He's a very bright guy, did very, very well. I talked to his high school teacher, who remembered him as just extremely smart, one of the top students he ever had, but also someone who, even when he was in high school, was snickering and sneering at the kids who were not as smart as he was.
So then he went to law school. He also was at the CIA.
He actually, you know, it's funny. He tried to go to his younger ambition was to be in the military himself, like his father. And he went to the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And something happened to him in his first year. He left partway through and wound up working in a fast food restaurant, and said later that he didn't find it academically challenging enough.
What, the fast food restaurant?
No, the Naval Academy. I don't really know. You know, there's some even when you spend a lot of time reporting, it's hard to get to the bottom of some things. And so anyway, he wound up changing course and going to Georgetown and then to Duke Law School. And then he went right to the CIA General Counsel's office.
Although he doesn't seem to have too much respect for the CIA.
Well, it's an irony, isn't it, that the general counsel of the CIA was particularly upset by not being brought into the process of making some of these rules later. But he had a particular take on the CIA I think forged very early, which was, he came in right as there had been a number of scandals during the Watergate years where the CIA was basically grounded and told that it needed to run things by Congress and there needed to be more oversight. And he objected to that. He felt that the public hearings of the CIA wrongdoing that took place in the Watergate years, he thought, were a disaster. So he's always been, from the start, someone who believes in government secrecy and who resists congressional oversight.
I'm talking with Jane Mayer. Her article about David Addington was in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. It was called The Hidden Power, The Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jane Mayer. She's written an article about David Addington, who is Vice President Cheney's chief of staff and has been a longtime legal advisor for the vice president. The article was called The Hidden Power, The Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror, and it is in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. I asked you earlier, why is he in the vice president's office? Many people feel that the vice president is the president, although others who have watched how the White House works say that that's not true. But does this tell us anything about how this whole thing works, that Addington is with the vice president?
I think it's very revealing. It's obvious that the vice president can't call every single shot, and he is not the front man. The president plays this very important role, obviously, as the person who is the, you know, the head of the country. But the vice president on all of these issues of national security really is the point man. And David Addington is his top lawyer on this. And the thing you have to keep in mind is that Dick Cheney and George Bush are not lawyers, and neither has been the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense. So there are not a lot of legal minds and people who really know the Constitution well at the very top of the government.
And you say this is atypical.
It is atypical in recent administrations. And what it results in many ways, is empowering the lawyer who is closest to them, the guy at their elbow, and that is this man, David Addington.
Well, he's replaced Scooter Libby, who is now facing legal problems. But is he doing the same job that Scooter did?
Hard to say. I mean, he is the chief of staff. I think it means that he's, from what I can tell, he's still very much involved in all of the legal issues. And of course, the legal issues have been very complex since the Supreme Court struck down many of the positions they took earlier. They have to kind of, reconfigure themselves.
Jane Harman, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said she believes that Cheney and Addington are still fighting Watergate. What do you think that
means? It's true. And one of the things that I found so interesting in reporting this story was that most people think, the cliche is September 11th changed everything, and that all of our kind of government policies that have to do with enhancing the presidential power started then. It's not true. What I found out was that Dick Cheney and David Addington and some other people in the administration, but they really are the people who are most adamant about this, have been trying to restore what they saw as a weakened presidency since Nixon's fall. They felt Nixon was too weakened by Watergate, or the presidency was too weakened, and they didn't like all of the new laws, the reforms that had to do with bringing Congress in for congressional oversight.
Did they believe Watergate wasn't a crime, or just not enough of a crime to have warranted the response?
Well, I've never heard them say or read anything where they've said it wasn't a crime. But they certainly seem to feel that it was a tragedy that resulted in hurting the presidency. And in particular, what really bugged both of them was they were both hawks on the Vietnam War, and they were very upset when Congress cut off funding for the Vietnam War. They felt that Congress was interfering in foreign policy.
But Vice President Cheney used to serve in Congress.
He did, but even when he was in Congress, he was very much on the side of the executive. And he had worked in the Ford White House and in other positions in the executive branch. So his allegiances have always really been to the executive branch, I think you could say.
And when he was a ranking member of the House committee that investigated Iran-Contra, he revealed those sentiments.
Yeah, this was phenomenal to me also. What you would find if you took a close look and Addington was working with Cheney at this point, Cheney's positions were that, unlike almost everybody else, when they looked at Iran-Contra, what they saw was that the president was wronged. Rather than seeing him as having overstepped his limits, by trying to wage a secret war in Nicaragua, they thought he was within his rights by trying to fund the Contras, even though the money that was used during that period to fund the Contras was coming from other countries. Remember, they hit up the Saudis and others. And, at the time, George Shultz, who was then the Secretary of State, said, this could be an impeachable offense. It wasn't just Democrats who saw this as a legal problem. But in many ways, Cheney and Addington's point of view on this is really extreme, and it's gone way back. And it's quite radical.
Do they think that Congress should be made privy to some of these secret pieces of information?
The less the better. And basically what they've done is they've really made the circle tiny of congressional officers who know anything about the covert programs that they run.
And so Addington was already, he worked for the commission, or did he work for that House committee, or was he already working for Dick Cheney?
He worked for the House committee, and Cheney was on it as well, that was investigating Iran-Contra, and they came up with this very surprising minority report that nobody really paid much attention to at the time. I was actually covering all those issues at the time. I don't remember it from then. You go back and look at it now, and you can see sort of a blueprint for their thinking, which is the president should call the shots on foreign policy, and Congress be damned.
So as you said, Secretary of State George Shultz expressed doubts about the legality of Iran-Contra. He was left out of the loop, as as these plans were developed. Are there parallels with how the current administration treated Secretary of State Colin Powell, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, these among other things that you can see is that David Addington, through his years of being in government, and Cheney as well, they're great infighters. I mean, they understand really how to work the bureaucracy. And when there's somebody who opposes them, they just cut them out of the loop. So so that's why, you know, Powell doesn't find out till very, very late that the Geneva Conventions have been thrown out. By the time he finds out, it's the president's already on board. It's too late to change something like that.
Has Powell talked about Addington?
He not directly to me, but I understand that he has said that very clearly Addington doesn't give a damn about the Constitution.
They were supporting Ronald Reagan at the time of Iran-Contra. Reagan talked a lot about small government. But was that a time of expansion of presidential powers?
Well, it was. I mean, many people thought that Reagan restored some of the grandeur of the presidency. He was very, you know, interested in the symbolism, and they, you know, made the East Room look good when he gave press conferences, and he gave, you know, beautiful speeches and restored the bully pulpit aspect of the presidency. And, you know, one of the things that was going on during the Reagan administration was that Casey was the head of the CIA, and he was a believer in all kinds of covert actions that, you know, he hoped to try to run around Congress. So yeah, you can see the seeds of the current policies there.
My guest is Jane Mayer, who wrote an article about David Addington, the chief of staff and legal advisor to Vice President Cheney, called The Hidden Power, the Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror, for the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. We were happy to be able to catch up with her today to talk about it, since this is a story that continues to unfold. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A former top national security lawyer told you that Addington, I'm quoting, takes a political litmus test of everyone. If you're not sufficiently ideological, he would cut the ground out from under you.
He is a very controversial figure, even within the White House. It's funny, when this story came out, and it's a tough story on him, I expected people might be upset. Instead, what I heard back was that a lot of the people in the White House were happy to have it out there, because he's not a popular figure. He's a very rough infighter, and cutting the ground out from under people is the least of it in some ways. I mean, he's some people describe him as a bully. He's verbally very hard on people.
But John Bolton was described as a bully as well. Is that a style that's appreciated in the White House?
Well, I suppose you can say that it seems to be carrying the day in some ways. You know, the ethic that developed around some of these meetings where Addington was presiding was that if you opposed him, you were soft. He was considered strong on national defense, and if you were against him, then they equated it with being soft on terrorism, or maybe even sort of trying to coddle terrorists. So it was very hard to make the constitutional arguments against him.
One of the contradictions in this administration is that it has really been wanted to come down hard on people who leak things, and yet, as we've learned, a lot of leaking has occurred. Is Addington one of the leakers?
Well, I can't say that with any certainty. There are certainly things from his point of view that leaked out and hurt the people who were opposing him, who were described again as soft on terrorism. In particular, he was in battle with people at the State Department a lot, and also with people at the National Security Council. But whether he leaked it or not, who can tell, you know?
Well, he is the vice president's legal advisor, so you have to wonder whether he was connected at all with the leak that involved Joseph and Valerie Plame Wilson.
He was involved in terms of advising Scooter Libby about some of the things having to do with what the CIA would have known about Valerie Plame and her husband's employment. He plays a very backstage role there, and nobody's been able to flesh it out further, and I know he's not a target of that particular legal investigation. You know, and the thing about Addington in the press, though, that would make it hard to imagine him leaking is, from what I can tell, he can't stand the press. He doesn't seem to have close relationships with anybody in it. As you mentioned in the beginning of the show, he's a very mysterious figure. He doesn't like to have his picture taken.
We do have some pictures.
There are some that have been taken, kind of, you know, pictures of people in the Situation Room, and you'll see him standing in the shadows behind, you know, the central figures. I mean, he he, you know, you can see him, but he just does not go anywhere near the limelight, and is, you know, keeps his office locked. It's filled with all kinds of secret documents, and nobody else is allowed in it. And you know, I tried so many times to see if I could get him to give me an interview for this story, and I sent him emails. I talked to his family. I talked to his mom and his sister and his friends, and you know, I mean, he just doesn't want to go anywhere near the press.
What was his mother like?
His mother seemed delightful, and of course, like all mothers, very proud. But she also said, you know, she had been told, she'd been warned by him not to speak to the press. So much as she would like to have talked about the family, she'd been well-schooled.
But I get the feeling he would not ever consider running for office because this is not the most extroverted person in the world.
He's not extroverted, and he doesn't seem to be running, you know, the kind of person who would be able to win too many votes, but he is outspoken. I mean, he is not mousy. In meetings, people describe him as the loud voice in the room, and he berates people sometimes. I mean, there's a famous confrontation where a young lawyer from the Defense Department tried to go in and get him to revisit the issue of whether or not we should treat detainees as is required under the Geneva Conventions and not, you know, abuse them. And this young lawyer who went in to see him was called in by Addington for trying to reopen the issue and just chewed out royally. It was, you know, in most cases, in high places in this administration, people are polite. They hear each other out. There's a great sense of decorum and of history. But what you hear about David Addington is that he raises his voice and people feel bullied.
What's taking place on the warrantless wiretapping front? Will the White House allow more congressional oversight of its program?
Well, you know, in some ways, if you're in some readings of the Hamden decision, it suggests that they really have to abide by the FISA Act. And it's, you know, some of the restrictions on the White House that the White House has decided were optional are not optional, according to the Supreme Court. Instead, what the White House has been doing is now trying to get Congress to change the laws so that the laws support their point of view. That's what they're doing with the military tribunals as well.
But even when Congress passes laws, the president often issues a signing statement which says, I don't necessarily agree to go along with this law. The response to the Supreme Court decision suggested that the administration didn't necessarily feel it had to go along with the Supreme Court's decision. So is this Addington's idea that it doesn't really matter what anybody else says, we're just going to do what we do?
Well, there's a quote in the story from Richard Epstein, who's a law professor at the University of Chicago, quite conservative himself, and he basically thinks that we're heading into a constitutional crisis over these issues. I think I'm watching as a reporter to see how they work it out over after Hamden's decision. Either the administration gives up some ground and listens to the court, or they don't. And, you know, it's unclear yet what they're going to do about it.
Do you think Addington has been writing into the president's signing statements?
Well, that is what people around him say. One lawyer described him to me as they used to call him the octopus, because it seemed his hands were sort of in everything, and including all of these signing statements. It's kind of an art form that he perfected. I mean, there have been other White Houses that have had signing statements.
Oh, it goes all the way back to the beginning.
It does.
I think Washington
did
one or two.
Sure. I mean, and the president, I mean, in their defense, is not supposed to sign or is not supposed to support legislation anyway that he sees as unconstitutional, because he, you know, the whole role of the presidency is to support the Constitution. But there's just such a substantial difference in how this administration behaves. Whereas other administrations have maybe, you know, put out a handful of signing statements, they've put out, I think, 750 now.
Representative John Murtha tried to cut federal funding for any intelligence gathering that violates the Fourth Amendment. Any idea of what Addington's response was?
Well, you know, he basically wrote a signing statement saying we will, you know, sign this bill that included Murtha's language. But when it comes to that paragraph that has to do with how we need to behave here, we take exception. So, I mean, the issue is then, can the president, you know, it's up to Congress to write the laws. Can the president just say, well, yes, I'll go along with some of them and some parts of them and not others? A number of you know, legal scholars, including the American Bar Association recently, have said that this is really problematical.
Although it's the equivalent of a line item veto, isn't it?
But the line item veto, it is. And the line item veto was struck down by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional. So it's a backdoor way of getting a line item veto.
When we look at previous presidents who have been accused of overstepping their authority, two come to mind, Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Lincoln because of the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War, Roosevelt with the Japanese internment, among other things. They are considered two of the greatest presidents we've ever had.
And they are exactly those examples are what are cited by this administration in saying they are within their rights because it's a wartime again, and presidents during wartime need to step beyond the laws. I interviewed one of the most renowned historians living today, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., about this to see what he thought, because he's an expert in the presidency. And his point was, yes, those things have happened in the past in this country, but they've been aberrations and they have been disgraces, really, in retrospect. And what he suggests is that this administration has taken those aberrations and woven them into a doctrine of their right. They've taken the wrongs of the past and turned it into a notion of what the president ought to do. He in particular, he's famous for having written The Imperial Presidency, which was about Richard Nixon. And I asked him, well, how does this White House compare with Nixon in terms of imperiousness? And he said he felt that this president has aggrandized himself more than any president in history.
Do you think that Addington and Cheney and Bush, for that matter, would have still pushed ahead for the new paradigm if 9/11 had never taken place?
I'm not sure they would have had the opportunity. I mean, certainly they would have done what they could have. And you can see even before 9/11, there were things like the Energy Task Force, where they brought people into the White House to advise them and refused to tell the public who they were bringing in. There were other ways where they seemed to be trying to, have a strong presidency. I'm sure they would have liked to, but basically what 9/11 did was it provided the platform. We have all been frightened by terrorism, and we all want to make the country stronger and protect the country. And they have used that sentiment to allow themselves to enact a number of steps that they probably would have liked to have done anyway.
Jane Mayer's article called The Hidden Power, The Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror, appeared in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. I'm so pleased you could stop by to talk about it today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.